Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books and East European Studies podcast series. I'm your host, Amanda Jean Swain, at the University of California, Irvine. Today, we'll be talking with Scott Miranda about his recent book, The People's Own Landscape, Nature, Tourism, and Dictatorship in East Germany, published by the University of Michigan Press. And I learned a lot from reading this book about both environmental history of East Germany, but also approaches to studying the relationship between state and society, and the role that landscape planning and the natural environment and people's engagement with that natural environment can reveal a lot of the political and social relationships in a country, and particularly in East Germany, which was a country seeking to define itself during the period that Scott covers in his book. So welcome to New Books in East European Studies, Scott.
Hey, Amanda. Thanks for inviting me. I'm excited to be here.
Great. So to start off, please tell us a bit about yourself and how you became interested in being a historian, and in particular about studying Germany and East Germany.
Yeah, so my connection to the history of East Germany comes from a couple of different places. One is personal biography, as these things often are. And I was born in West Berlin. I'm not German, but my mother was a language specialist for army intelligence. And so she was at Teufelsberg in West Berlin, a listening station manned by the U.S. Army and by the NSA. And she was listening to Russian and East German phone calls and translating texts and things like that. So I always had this personal curiosity about the Cold War and East and Germany because of that history. I got my PhD at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, working with Rudy Koshar. And Rudy is a scholar who at the time was very much interested in tourism, consumer society, heritage management, and things like that. And so as I was working with him, I was immersed in issues of consumer desires and tourism. And that's really kind of where I started thinking about this project as a dissertation. I also had an interest in environmental history and took a seminar with Bill Cronin at the University of Wisconsin and hoped to somehow merge the two. And as the dissertation evolved, what began as purely a history of tourism in East Germany became more and more looking at the intersections of tourism and environment. So I began to think of it more as an environmental history as much as a tourism history. Mm-hmm. So the interest in tourism was there, in part informed by my doctoral advisor, and my interest in history had just kind of emerged partly because of my own biography.
Mm-hmm. And obviously those of you who are listening to the podcast can't see this, but I'm talking to Scott over the Zoom conferencing software. And so I can see he's got maps up on the wall behind his head. And we will be talking a lot about these concepts of mapping and determining how not just what territory is there, but how to define that territory and how to relate to that territory within East Germany. But you argue for historical continuity, situating East German approaches to natural resources in the context of 19th century German anxieties about scarcity and abundance. So before we talk about East Germany, which was formed after World War II. Explain for us these continuities that you see and give us the grounding that we need in 19th century German thinking about landscape and landscape planning.
Yeah, so when it comes to landscape planning, tourism, and environmental protection, there these three topics have long histories in Germany. With environmental protection, the homeland protection associations beginning in the 1890s, 1880s and 1890s, mostly middle-class groups seeking to protect rural, agricultural, and pastoral landscapes from urban sprawl and commercialization. And partly related to that, there was a long tradition, kind of a statist tradition in Germany of planning the landscape to maximize economic efficiency, productivity, but also to protect and cultivate health, public health, and individuals. And then the history of tourism, which had largely been a more middle-class phenomenon, but increasingly something that the working classes were involved in, especially in the 1920s and the 1930s in Germany. So Germany became associated very strongly as a country of tourists, a country of nature lovers, forest lovers, a country of hikers and outdoors enthusiasts. And what was interesting to me was thinking, well, you know, here comes this new regime that for many Germans was a complete imposition, completely had nothing to do with these continuities of German national identity and culture. So what happens to these continuities is you could, particularly if you're taking a more totalitarian view of East German regime, you could see it as a complete imposition with no continuity, just destroys what was there before. And I wanted to find out how true that was. And environmental history of East Germany hadn't really, I felt, engaged in those continuities that crossed 1945. They had been, you know, there had been interest in how the communist regime had harmed the environment. And then there was the emergence in the 1970s and 80s of within the church of a very, very kind of modern ecological movement that has much in common with movements in Western Europe in the 1970s. So when people are thinking about the environment, was it all new emerging out of 1968, 1970s, or are they drawing on something longer as tourists, as conservationists, as planners?
Mm-hmm. And what were a couple of the key ideas that they were looking back to that were very specifically coming out of the 19th century?
There was particularly ideas about the opposition between consumerism and public well-being. There's this German anxieties that modern commercialism, particularly as shaped by Anglo-American capitalism, by American popular culture, was undermining German national culture, but also was a threat to psychological and physical well-being. So that idea had been there for a long time. I think another longer tradition is the idea that capitalism can be and needs to be managed, that the scarcities of World War One, the scarcities of the turbulence of capitalism in the 1920s, and to a certain degree, some of the scarcities of during the war, World War II, any new regime had to, as part of its promise, had to promise a better life that would get rid of those inefficiencies of scarcities and that turbulence. To a certain degree, landscape planners have been trying to do that going back to the 19th century, to manage consumerism, manage growth in such a way that it wasn't threatening. And so that discussion, those ideas about the state management of capitalism, of commercialism, of consumerism, have been part of a German conversation for a long time. And German socialists have their own understandings of the state and the economy, but they're also building on these larger German discussions.
Mm-hmm. So to move on to socialist conceptions of that, give us a really brief summary of how the East German state even came into being and what kind of system they were, the new leaders of this new country were trying to implement.
Yeah. There had been a strong social democratic and communist movement in Germany since the 19th century. And some of the founders of the East German state emerged from that. Some had been persecuted by the Nazis as communists or as social democrats. Now, the founding of East Germany, though, would not have happened without, of course, the Red Army. Many of the eventual German leaders of East Germany had spent the war in Russia, in Moscow, and kind of were flown in once the Red Army was there to set up this new state. And it was a state very much aligned with what at the time were Stalinist ideas about democratic centralism and the relationship between the government and the people. It was, you know, there wasn't any real democracy there. It was kind of central planning from the SED, the Socialist Unity Party, which was the ruling party in East Germany. And they had a vision of the economy and the political system that was very, in many ways, very similar to the Soviet Union. Maybe I should say more. I don't know.
No, that's good. Sometimes we have people who aren't necessarily East Europeanist listening to podcasts. So we always like to at least cover some of the basics. So we have this new state being formed in large part because of the presence of the Soviet army after World War II and on the German territory. And they faced a lot of challenges, not least of which was convincing people that who now lived in this German Democratic Republic or DDR that they should be loyal to this new state. How did the leadership attempt to use athletic tourism in the late 1940s to define this new territory, this new Germany, and to mobilize the population towards its ideological goals?
Yeah. So it was a state with very little legitimacy when it emerged, except for a small committed core of working class communists. And the regime was very wary and mistrustful of many aspects of German national culture, particularly middle class culture, and hiking and nature preservation, they argued, was linked to romanticism, was linked to kind of an avoidance of hard economic social class issues. But it was an escape. And in fact, that romanticism was in part mobilized outdoor activities to undermine the working class movement. So the idea that East Germans, after the war, would be out there camping, hiking, rock climbing on their own, and in doing so would be kind of engaging in a culture and idea that predated the East Germans and communism, and maybe thus having conversations and discussions that might be threatening to this new regime. Initially, the relationship with outdoor tourism, nature tourism, was very antagonistic. There was a German association for hiking and rock climbing formed within the East German Athletic Association after the war, and all popular activities were kind of put under state mass organizations, as would have been the case in Eastern Europe as well. So if you wanted to participate in a sport, you had to join the official sports organization. And in this case, if you wanted to hike or rock climb, you had to join the sports organization. There was also a culture league that organized hiking to a certain degree outside the sports organization. But I look in particular at the sports organization, how they use athletic competition as a means to remove from hiking that romantic notion of kind of a spiritual escape into nature, and to make that nature experience something that better inculcates certain values among citizens. It promotes hard work. It promotes competition. It prepares citizens to be good workers, good soldiers, to fight for a communist regime. This is not a great way to win loyalty because often this meant they underfunded family activities or projects that would have supported family hiking, that would have supported kind of more unorganized, uncompetitive type of nature outings. And I opened the book there. Really, that first chapter is the regime trying to stamp out what it saw as dangerous bourgeois romantic naturalism through this idea of competition.
Well, another way in which this new regime probably was not winning a lot of people over is that the Soviet style emphasis is on developing heavy industry as in economic development. And so that was bound to create conflict with conservationists, with whether formally organized and identified as such, or even just people who wanted to have these natural areas next to their hometowns. So tell us in particular about the political debates over the proposed national park near Dresden and what that reveals about the relationship between the conservationist and the state in these early decades of the German Democratic Republic.
Yeah, so especially in those early decades, as you said, the regime was focused on heavy industry and increasing just raw productivity of timber, of coal, of iron, and other industrial products. And as throughout Eastern Europe was wary of consumerism, not just for the reasons many Germans, as I mentioned earlier, were wary of consumer desires, but for what we would call Marxist reasons, that these were false desires and they were consumerism was a way to distract workers from what really mattered and consumerism promoted inequality. So that's the emphasis of the state, and that means more pollution, that means more destruction of the forests. And often in popular and occasionally in scholarly accounts of East Germany and the environment, that's the story of heavy industry, the state's attempt to increase productivity at all costs, regardless of how it affects human health or environmental health. With the national park, our proposal for a national park in Saxon Switzerland, this little region outside of Dresden, I try to show that, yes, the state is overly focused on increasing agricultural, forest, and industrial productivity. But it understands two things. One, it needs political legitimacy, and one way to get that is to offer better living standards. And that can be defined in many different ways. That would include more leisure activities and sports, improving public health. And they particularly wanted to promote aspects of living standards that did not mean buying TVs and cars. So tourism was a nice, and sports were nice ways to say, hey, we're helping you, so therefore we're a good government. They also, in the name of industrial productivity, wanted workers to be more productive. And the idea that recreation would rejuvenate workers for the workday was important. Now, some landscape planners landscape architects already cared about the environment, and they had been thinking about how recreation molds personalities even before 1945. But here, I argue that they saw a way to engage the regime and say, "Hey, you profess to care about living standards and popular well-being, public health in particular. That if you say capitalism leads to poor health and leads to misery, inequality, homelessness, and you're offering something else, well, where that recreation is happening is out there in those forests. And if those forests are not managed in a sensible way, then recreation is going to be undermined, and therefore these other things you claim to care about will be undermined." And I think this gets these landscape architects some traction. They are able to present this not as a reactionary, bourgeois, outmoded nature protection project, but in fact a very modern element of a well-managed, centrally planned economy. That planned economy should actually pay attention to these things too, that these things being tourism, infrastructure, landscapes, parks, things like that.
Mm-hmm. You argue that looking at East German camping culture within the context of East German consumer politics reveals what you call messy boundaries between state and society. Explain what you mean by that.
Yeah. I'll start with a source that I mentioned in the book, a good entry point for that. In 1990, I found a complaint in a small town near a campground that had been very popular during the GDR. And they describe it as a SED space, a Social Unity Party space, basically something imposed by this horrible regime and ruined their local culture and landscape. And I challenge that by saying, well, actually, yes, the state is monitoring and making sure certain activities aren't happening in that space. They are dictating ultimately what gets built, who gets to vacation there. Yes. And I really hoped throughout the book to never lose sight of the fact that this is a coercive regime. But at the same time, that campground and other campgrounds like it were as much created by the vacationers themselves. And those vacationers are often asking the state to intervene. They're not just escaping the state. They're asking the state to intervene to provide better infrastructure, more camping spaces, or some other aspect of their experience. And or they are pushing the regime to better appease these desires they have for campgrounds and vacation spaces. And the regime is concerned about responding to those popular desires. And so I try to follow in a very material way the development of the campground and kind of show the ways in which the regime isn't just creating what they want, but ultimately end up creating something that is partly what they want, partly what vacationers from Karl Marx City, from Berlin, from Dresden, what they want. Sometimes what gets left out is maybe the local small towns. Maybe they're not being paid attention to, but that this is a, and that's what I mean by messy, that this is, these spaces are hybrid spaces. They are a mix of popular and top-down state creations.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I found really interesting in the book was your argument that the East German regime not only had to redefine what it meant to be German, because thinking of oneself as German, but also it had to position itself against these local regional identities, and that the local Heimat was as important as, you know, sort of the big Germany. And so you talk a lot about that as well, that the interplay between this landscape planning and the relationship to how people identified with their local communities and regional landscapes. So tell us more about the Greifenbach Reservoir and how that, all of that tension came to play out in that particular space.
Yeah. There's a lot of good work on the persistence of local identity in ways that may be resistant to the new regime. And I think that's, in many cases, there's a lot to that argument. Greifenbach in this space, this is in Saxony. It is in the vicinity of what is today Chemnitz, in the Ore Mountains or the Erzgebirge. And, you know, so this had been a space that people from Saxony, from Chemnitz, from Dresden had been vacationing, particularly middle classes have been hiking for a while. So when the regime is creating bungalows, is creating campgrounds for workers from outside the region, there is a tension between the needs of this kind of a working class and emerging white-collar class, people who work in party offices or other planning offices in Berlin and other regional capitals. Tension between meeting their needs and then meeting the needs of a local family who wants to go out and maybe spend the weekend in their own backyard, so to speak. And so often some locals will complain that they did not have a camp spot because it was being taken by someone from Berlin or from Dresden. So that's one tension between the center and the local, the regional, that emerges. I really tend to focus on this group that's kind of in between the government at the center and these local towns and villages. That is this this emerging civil service class, white collar, what we might call white collar class, and how these campgrounds are really created for them, and how they are seeking vacation spaces, which are scarce, which are hard to get. And this leads to conflicts that often have reveal social inequalities, who has access to these spaces, who does not have access to these spaces. But it also, I think, remaps to a certain degree the mental geography of East Germans that, you know, before there are these local Heimats, these local homelands, could be Saxony, could be the Erzgebirge, and then there's the greater national homeland of the German nation. And there's not any loyalty to this strange creation called East Germany. It doesn't map onto any historic space. It includes a few different provinces that had some historical reason to be, but East Germany itself never a state that particular size and shape before. But as this new civil service emerges, there's not, you know, it's hard to get a car in East Germany, but as more and more East Germans are going out to camp in the countryside, especially those who do have access to a car and are able to accrue a camp space and camping equipment, instead of just traveling to a Berliner, traveling to the immediate Brandenburg countryside, they may be going to the Erzgebirge more often. And they're doing that not just on by train, but in their own cars. And that this geography of automobility and of individual camping, people begin, maybe some East Germans are imagining a larger vacation space that does not overlay exactly with these old regional identities, even though those identities and those identities are still there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I did get the impression from your book that in the 1970s, East Germans were more interested in arguing with each other over bungalows than in opposing the socialist state. And so can you delve into that a little bit more and how this what the tensions then within this supposedly classless society, and yet how consumerism, particularly related to tourism, was perhaps creating or revealing some of these class differences.
So how did one get access to a bungalow, a cottage at a campground or even a campsite? Some of that had to do with political connections. If you were a party official, or if you were in local party officialdom, it was easier to gain access. Some of it had to do with where you worked. If you worked at a large factory, you're probably better guaranteed a spot than a tradesperson, a carpenter or mechanic of some sort. And then if you had access to raw materials or cash, either because you had relatives in West Germany or because maybe you had a job where maybe there's extra wood laying around you could help build a bungalow with, this might help you acquire these spaces. And increasingly, the people without bungalows began to associate these bungalows with people from the cities, Berlin, from Dresden, and in particular with party officials, but also these bureaucrats who work for planning offices, economic planning offices, that may not be members of the party, but because of their job, have access to these spaces. And so lots of letters of complaints where talking about how people are not allowed to build a bungalow are building them anyway, how public access to lakeshores is being undermined by the proliferation of these bungalows, which kind of parcel up the landscape, and a real sense that some East Germans have access to better consumer goods, better vacations than others. And people who complained would use the language of socialist equality to criticize this inequality. And for environmental protection, this is really interesting because in the 70s and 80s, in West Germany and in the West in general, you see an environmentalism emerging that's very critical of consumer abundance as, you know, creating lots of garbage, creating lots of waste, contributing ozone damage to the ozone layer, climate change, things like that. And then I look at these tourists complaining about poor access to green spaces, to vacation areas in the mountains, at the beaches, on the lakesides. They're both arguing for better distribution of consumer goods and for green space. And I argue that the two become linked, and that their popular environmentalism, they wouldn't have called it that, but their engagement with environmental issues isn't anti-consumer, but in fact is the two things go hand in hand. We are deprived both of consumer goods and of green space, and we need both. And the state should do a better job distributing those goods. And that's a very different way of thinking about the landscape than some of the more political ecology that's emerging in the West at the time.
Mm-hmm. You say that the new environmental law that was passed in the early 1970s made it appear that the conservationists had won in the sense of making that a priority within the state. So what happened, and why did it only appear to be a victory for land conservationists?
Yeah. So in that chapter, I try to connect tourism to this new environmental law in the early 1970s. And basically say that what had, beginning with that national park proposal in the 1950s near Dresden, this argument that tourism justifies landscape planning and landscape protection had been used by conservationists who were on the out, so didn't necessarily have great influence. But by the 1970s, this argument that recreation, tourism, depends on good landscape planning has become, I guess you could say, more mainstream. And it shapes this Landeskulturgesetz, this landscape protection law in 1970-1971. And much of its justification, much of its language is talking about the protection of landscapes for the benefit of public health, for the benefit of vacationing by everyday East Germans. So that, in that sense, it looks like they've won. This language they've used, the arguments that they've been making have seemed to have triumphed. The state is very early in Europe recognizing the need for a comprehensive landscape protection, which this law embodies. Now, one could argue the law was just a political window dressing because there were international conferences, environmental movement internationally, and it was a way to make the East Germans look better than the West Germans. And it was an element of that. When I say that the conservationists had in some ways won, I think this law also emerged from a domestic East German conversation about public health, tourism, and nature. But they ended up losing in the sense that the regime really ultimately, when it talked about tourism, cared most about making sure the public had as many tents and campgrounds and sausages at the local at the campground as they could get, and so it became the landscape protection law became as much about modifying and opening up landscape reserves for more and more tourists as it did about protecting those tourists. So the planning part was often focused on increasing the number of tourists and not about managing for the health of both tourists and nature. So some of the characters in my book who are often argued that tourism justified environmental planning begin increasingly to back off and say tourism is a threat to good landscape planning, that it is another sign of the lack of central planning in East Germany, that things are just kind of gone haywire.
Mm-hmm. And I was surprised in your book, and it's one of the key points you're trying to make, is the degree to which that vacationers, landscape planners, and economic authorities were able to find common ground at various points. But as we know, that really broke down by the 80s, and in part because East Germany's ecological and economic problems were becoming quite severe. So can you give us some examples of environmental degradation at the time and how this began to galvanize the East German public around the need for conservation?
One of the big things in the 1980s is what the Germans called forest death, sulfur dioxide pollution, and the impact it had on the forests of Germany, particularly in East Germany. so many, East Germany, it was obvious right in front of them, not only were the waters polluted, but the trees were dying, literally dying right in front of them. And that phenomenon, there's a lot of causes for it, and they're very complicated and often not as simple as environmentalists portray them to be. But one of the causes was the oil crisis in the 1970s. East Germany's supply of oil was largely cut off. As oil prices rose, the Soviets stopped supplying much of that oil, in part because they wanted to sell it to increase their revenue, which meant that for the plastics industry and for many other industries, East Germany is increasingly dependent on coal. And East Germany has access to some of the dirtiest brown coal that exists, which is particularly prone to sulfur dioxide. And this creates a real sense of the limits to growth for many observers in East Germany, that the only way the economy can grow is burning more brown coal, which means very clear destruction, not just of trees, but of lungs and buildings and other things through acid rain and other problems. And that consensus I talk about, it's not a consensus that Marxism is good. It's not a consensus that they all love Honecker or Ubrecht, the leaders of East Germany. There's a consensus, the idea that a state can promote what seemingly would seem like limitless growth, that the economies can grow if they're properly managed, if they're with good technology, with scientific management. And that at the same time, if things are done right, you can keep green spaces, you can care for the landscape and both grow the economy and preserve green spaces for the public and preserve public health. And increasingly in the 1980s, some people begin to doubt whether that's true. Some first conservationists who had seen tourism as an ally, one reason they begin to doubt it is because the tourism numbers go up and increasingly they see unsightly messes near campgrounds, near beaches in East Germany. But also that the pollution they see in front of them in the forests encourages that idea. And that's really where this political movement, environmental movement in the 1980s challenges the notion of limitless growth and begins to, as the Greens in West Germany were doing, to suggest that maybe there are limits, that natural biophysical limits to what we can.
Yeah, and I think many of us who think about the end of East Germany really identify the environmental movement as having a predominant role in the political unrest that was happening by the late 80s. So can you talk more about that political unrest and the relationship between the green movement or the Greens in East Germany and kind of broadly what was happening between the breakdown of the relationship between state and society?
So for various reasons, the church in East Germany became a refuge for political dissidents. And this involved a mix of anti-nuclear activists, peace activists, vegetarians, environmentalists, all kinds of groups. Sometimes the same person was all of these within these church-based organizations. And they increasingly began to make arguments about the need for environmental care, but this was associated with an idea of individual responsibility, of changing the way government functions, moving toward a more democratic regime. So the environmental movement was kind of very much at the heart of this dissident movement in the 1980s that really kind of blows up after 1986 with Gorbachev and also after Chernobyl, not coincidentally. What was intriguing to me is that for many of these dissidents organized within the church, they made very similar arguments to environmentalists in the West, which was a very nonconformist, anti-mainstream, critical of consumerism argument in a country known for consumer scarcity and known for its envy of West German consumer products and vacations in Mallorca and abroad. So this seemed to me, there must be a tension here. And, indeed, in the former East, the Green Party has not fared particularly well, particularly in the countryside or in the smaller cities. And so, you know, one way I explore this, and I have to say I struggle with, was I doing justice to the 1980s environmentalist movement? My book was not necessarily about them, but that's what everyone knows about when it comes to East Germany and the environment. I started with tourism, and that's consumerism, I use that to explore among some of these dissidents, what is their relationship with tourists? How are they engaging with them? In many ways, they're critical of what I call the popular discourse, which is seeking vacation spots and more TVs and cars and things like that. And then so there's a tension between the dissidents organized within the church and everyday East Germans about what exactly they want. All of them are upset about the destruction of the environment, about inequalities. But I think that the dissidents in the church organizations and the environmental organizations have a very much stronger and clearer position that consumerism actually is propping up the socialist state. And socialists are basically winning the loyalty by what was called consumer socialism, Honecker's policies of making sure people had basic amount of meat, basic goods, maybe not luxuries, but you know, basic goods, and that this was propping up a dictatorial regime, and they consistently are making that argument. At the same time, they want vacation spaces as well, so that you know their engagement with tourism is complicated also.
Mm-hmm. You've mentioned West Germany a couple times, and I think our conversation wouldn't be complete if you didn't tell us a little bit about the relationship between conservation and the state in East Germany and how that compared to what was happening in in West Germany over time, and where it converged and where they came together, and to what extent were West German environmentalists and engaged with conservationists in East Germany?
I'd say up to the 1970s, there are a lot of similarities. Environmentalism in West Germany, there's a lot of landscape architects and regional planners involved trying to control what this is exponential growth of West German cities. And a lot of discussion about the need for recreation and outdoor space as wrapped up in that conversation. Of course, it doesn't have the same kind of authoritarian molding of personalities that you see in East Germany. What begins to emerge as distinct in West Germany, in which West Germany shares a lot with the U.S., France, and other Western European countries, is the 68 generation and its critique of its kind of third way critique of capitalism and critique of consumerism informs a environmentalism of the Green Party that is very much promoting the limits to growth and promoting alternative lifestyles. Now, some of those West German activists engaged a lot with the East German environmental movement that had been organized within the church. They shared literature, they visited, they sometimes would make sure that pamphlets or videos made in East Germany are aired or published in West Germany. So there is this engagement. And given that many of the Greens in the West have their own critique of capitalism, they're also interested in a conversation with Marxist-informed environmental critiques in the East. And so there's a common conversation there that's going on. But I wouldn't say the West German Greens are the reason the East German environmental movement emerged in the 1980s, but they definitely interacted.
Mm-hmm. Well, Scott, I thank you for talking to me and then with all of our listeners through the New Books in East European Studies podcast about your book, The People's Landscape. And as I said, I really enjoyed reading it. I felt like I learned a lot, and hopefully our listeners will pick up a copy and read it as well. And I'd like to close with our traditional question, which is, what are you working on now?
Yeah, something very different. Well, I love East Germany. I love reading sources different, against the grain to get at popular attitudes, whether that's complaint letters or newspaper reports or surveys of vacationers. I was ready to do something non-East German. And so I'm actually working on an environmental history that explores German critiques of American soil plunder from the 19th into the early 19th century into the early Cold War period. So America is kind of the bad example of how to manage and care for soil fertility and prevent erosion. And Germans kind of hold the U.S. up as this the negative to compare themselves to. And in turn, this helps the creation of a German national identity where care of the soil is so important. As you see that some people might be familiar with the Nazi blood and soil rhetoric and some of its promotion of peasants and Germans as better carers of the land than the Slavs to the east, supposedly. Right. And I'm looking to how the comparisons that are looking westward, how this notion of a particular German stewardship of the environment, particularly of soil, emerges in conversation with what's happening in the U.S.
Oh, great. Well, that does sound like an interesting project. And I suspect that when the book comes out, there might be someone from New Books in Environmental Studies who will be interested in talking to you about that book. And so keep us in mind when you are publishing that book. But for now, I appreciate that you took the time to talk with me today. And I also want to thank our listeners for listening to our podcast series. And we hope that you'll continue to join us for more conversations about new books and East European studies.